From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Molly Ivins is a liberal columnist from Texas. Her beat is stupidity in American politics. It gives her plenty to write about. On today's Fresh Air, Molly Ivins shares some of her favorite political stories. Today, the Senate began debate on the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. We ask Duke Law professor Walter Dellinger to critique the confirmation process. And from our archives, a talk with Nadine Gordimer, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature earlier today. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Brian Naylor. Reports in Haiti today of random attacks by soldiers that have left 150 dead and more than 300 wounded. Most of the reported attacks occurred between early Monday, when President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was ousted, and Wednesday. Radio Lumiere, a Protestant-run radio station, said 30 to 40 people were massacred in one Port-au-Prince neighborhood. A high-level delegation from the Organization of American States plans to fly to Haiti tomorrow. They'll try to convince the junta that seized power there on Monday to step aside and allow President Aristide to return. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
The delegation will personally inform junta leaders of the strong action taken by the OAS this morning, when the organization called for near-total economic sanctions against Haiti and urged further steps to isolate the coup leaders diplomatically. The delegation, which will include a senior official of the U.S. State Department, will not negotiate with the coup leaders, an administration source said today. The delegation will not entertain demands, he said, but will deliver a very strong message and then report back to the OAS. The OAS could take further steps against the regime in Haiti, including the creation of a multinational force to restore democracy there. President Aristide is currently in the United States, meeting with members of Congress and addressing the United Nations Security Council today. President Bush plans to meet with him tomorrow. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The House voted today to close the House bank following a recommendation by the Speaker of the House, Tom Foley. He admitted that he was one of the lawmakers to have written a bad check at the bank. Foley said a House panel will investigate whether lawmakers had engaged in what he called significant, substantial, and repeated abuses of the bank. Foley wrote a $540 check at the bank last December. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton has become the fifth major Democratic candidate for president. From member station KUAR, Hal McGowan reports.
Clinton promised an aggressive agenda of leadership that will restore the American dream when he announced today that he's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for president. With frequent interruptions by applause from an enthusiastic crowd of supporters, Clinton said the country is heading in the wrong direction fast.
Together we can provide the leadership that will restore the American dream, fight for the forgotten middle class, that will provide more opportunity, demand more responsibility from each of us, and create a stronger community in this great country of ours.
Clinton said he won't let today's children be part of the first generation of Americans to do worse than their parents. Governor Clinton is breaking a promise he made during his 1990 reelection campaign not to seek higher office. For National Public Radio, I'm Hal McCown in Little Rock.
On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing nearly 28 points to close at 2984.79. This is NPR News. The European Community will provide a package of food aid to the Soviet Union in a bid to avert possible food shortages this winter. Details of the arrangement will be released next week, but the amount of aid is thought to be somewhat less than the $10 billion the Soviets had requested. The BBC's Mark Brain has this report.
The Prime Minister declined to give any details, but said the package was substantial and would be submitted to European Community Finance Ministers for approval next Monday. As chairman of the Group of Seven main industrialized democracies, Mr. Major said he would then write to the United States, Canada, and to Japan to ask them to make a similar gesture. Mr. Major described the package of food and medical aid now agreed as a contingency arrangement to be drawn upon if needed. And he said a joint political delegation of the community and the G7 would be dispatched to the Soviet Union to discuss with the center and with the republics the logistics and volumes of any aid. Some $250 million of emergency food assistance from the European community is already on its way into the Soviet Union. Twice that sum in cheap credits has also been set aside, but has yet to be drawn down.
The BBC's Mark Brain. UN inspectors flew over Iraq today searching for Scud missiles. The 20-member team took off from Baghdad's Rashid military base. It was their first mission since Iraq challenged the UN inspection team's right to fly unrestricted over its airspace. Iraq also objected to the inspectors flying in their own helicopters without Iraqi escort. UN officials agreed to allow an Iraqi liaison officer to accompany each flight made by the three helicopters. President Bush's nominee to head the CIA, Robert Gates, says charges that he altered intelligence analysis to suit political aims is ridiculous. But some lawmakers say the tide is beginning to turn against Gates. Democrat Dennis DeConcini of Arizona said the burden of proof has shifted. I'm Brian Naylor, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Molly Ivins, is a political columnist known as much for her wit as her political insights. She's a lifelong Texas liberal who never pulls any punches when it comes to describing what's wrong with Texas, or for that matter, America. Ivins writes for the Dallas Times-Herald, Mother Jones, and The Nation, and contributes essays to the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. Her columns are collected in the new book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She? Here's the opening of her introduction.
In my youth, I aspired to be a great journalist. George Orwell, Albert Camus, and I.F. Stone were my heroes, great writers and intellectuals who helped illuminate their times. But look, God gave those guys fascism, communism, colonialism, and McCarthyism to struggle against. All I got was Lubbock. It's not my fault.
Do you still feel like you didn't get the big stories to cover?
I'm afraid so, although I must say there's enough real about the great state of Texas to keep anybody busy.
Well, it seems to me what your stories have turned out to be is Texas, women, and general overall stupidity in politics.
Well, it's hard to encompass the entire topic of stupidity in politics, but I have attempted to address it.
Why?
Well, mostly because it's sitting right under my nose and I find it hard to ignore. I've been writing about Texas politics for a long time, and that will give a person plenty of material.
You've written that as a lifelong Texas liberal, you've spent your whole life, your whole of your existence in a political climate to the right of Ronald Reagan. You're, in fact, from a family who was very right-wing. What was right-wing about them?
Well, my daddy was John Connally's campaign manager. I guess that qualifies.
All right.
I have to say, my daddy and I don't agree on much politically. In fact, it's true. I've about the political climate of Texas and what I think of as most of the real world. I define the real world as just about every place outside Manhattan Island. It has always sort of amazed and amused me that so many of these right-wing intellectuals, that they call the neoconservatives, seem to be operating under the bizarre impression that the world is actually run by people of the liberal persuasion, a notion I find so comical that I'm barely able to talk politics with those folks.
Were you ever an adolescent right-winger?
No. Mm-mm. I must say I turned out funny early.
What got you questioning the conservative worldview that your family had?
Well, I think all Southern liberals come from the same starting point, which is race. I grew up in the South before the Civil Rights Movement, and it was an era when all grown-ups lied. If you lived in the white part of town and you'd go to the drinking fountains, they'd say, "Now, don't drink out of that fountain, dear. That's dirty." That was the one that said colored on it. Well, of course, you lived in the white part of town, and kids had been crawling all over the white fountain all day. It was full of bubble gum and dirty grease marks and stuff. And you knew that the colored fountain wasn't dirty. There was something they weren't telling you. And you know how horribly logical little children can be. You just start picking up on those clues early on, and somehow I never got over it. The first great political question when I was coming up was civil rights, and I was in favor of it. And the second great political question to come along was the war in Vietnam, and I was against it. So people told me that meant I was some kind of double-dyed, full-blooded liberal. I said, okay, what did I know? Later on, people took to claiming that it meant I was in favor of big government and communism and high taxes. And that's when I figured out that I should never let anybody else define my politics.
Did you get into big fights with your family when you were coming of age and, you know, when you became a woman and started to have political views that differed with theirs?
Oh, yes. We ruined many a dinner discussing politics in my house. My daddy and I finally agreed not to do it anymore.
Is that still where you are now?
Yep.
Was your family prosperous? Were you a debutante? Did you have a coming out party?
No, I was not myself a debutante, but I went to debutante parties. I suppose to some extent did grow up in rather a privileged world. I went to a private school in Houston, Texas, and later went on to Smith College and Columbia University. Flavor of my political opinions, I think, comes not from... In part, I think I grew up different from other girls of my background simply because I read a great deal. And I suppose there was an additional factor. I'm almost 6 feet tall, which makes it hard to be a sweet, dainty, pretty, feminine, little, sweet, proper Southern belle. I mean, they made me captain of the basketball team when I was four, and that sort of went like that.
How were you introduced to the women's rights movement?
I'm trying to remember. I know. In 1972, I was editing the Texas Observer. I suppose it's redundant to say it's a small liberal Texas magazine. And Sissy Farenthold that year in 1972 was running, got nominated for vice president by the women's groups there at the Democratic Convention in 1972. And I didn't have any money as editor of the Texas Observer, and I was sleeping on the floor room in Sissy's hotel room in a sleeping bag, and kind of wound up as her aide-de-camp for this funny little effort to make her vice president that appeared. And that was when I first met Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan and Bella Abzug. And I was kind of startled because I had not quite realized how much my opinion of those leaders of the women's movement had been influenced by the media. For some reason, I had thought that Bella Abzug would be loud and brash and brassy. And she's actually the most sweet-voiced woman and sweet-faced woman. I thought Betty Friedan had always seemed to me sort of vaguely like a witch. Well, she turned out to be the classic Jewish mother, apt to pour chicken soup down your throat at the first sneeze. And Gloria Steinem, I had sort of assumed would be some sort of spoiled darling who always wanted to be in front of the cameras. Well, she was the one who, after we would have these strategy meetings, she would, after everybody else had gone off to do something important, she was the one who would sweep the floor and pick up. And then that was what caused me to realize how much sexism I had been reading in the national media about these women and about the women's movement, how they had managed to slant those personalities.
When did you start writing about the legislature, the Texas legislature, and what was your early response to it?
My first session was in 1971, and I walked onto the floor of the Texas House of Representatives, and it looked sort of like the first day of school. There were 150 men all slapping each other on the back and patting each other on the butt and meeting and greeting and carrying on, and I saw one old boy dig another old boy in the ribs with his elbow and say, "Hey, fella, you should see what I found myself last night, and she don't talk neither." And the two of them went off chortling and snuckling. And I just thought to myself, you know, this is fabulous. It makes some people kind of sick, but very from the beginning, I just thought, this is reporter heaven. This is too funny to be believed, and I've been writing about it that way ever since.
It's good that you were able to keep your bearings and think that you were sane and they were crazy. Not everybody thrown into such a situation would be able to maintain their bearings.
Oh, if you had ever witnessed that collection of geeks and dorks and bozos we have in the state legislature of Texas, I don't think you'd have much trouble.
Do you think that the Texas legislature is any worse than any other states?
Certainly, we're number one bad, and I'll fight to the death with anybody who says we're not. Actually, I do have to tell you, of course, there's great politics over our neighboring state of Louisiana. And in a political storytelling contest, I often get a run for my money with folks from New Jersey and Illinois. But I have been in political storytelling contests all over this country with my fellow political writers, and I've never lost one. All I have to do is keep telling true stories about the Texas legislature, and sooner or later they all give up and say uncle.
Can you tell one of your favorites for us?
Well, there's so many it's hard to say, but perhaps my all-time favorite Texas representative was Mike Martin from Longview. He was an early harbinger of the moral majority. Got elected on a platform of being pro-family and pro-American, but frankly, if you'd put that man's brain in a bumblebee, it would have flown backwards. He could not get a single bill passed, not even memorial resolutions for people in his district who had died. So when it came time for re-election, of course, kind of hard to get re-elected if you hadn't done anything. Looked bad for Mike's re-election chances, but he came up with an innovative scheme. He paid his cousin Charlie to shoot him in the arm with a shotgun. Then he claimed it had been done by a satanic and communistic cult. And here were the law enforcement people running all over Texas trying to find some satanic communistic cult, which is fairly hard to do. And there was great uproar in the press about it, and everybody running around thinking people, the lives of legislators were in danger, and nobody knew what to think about it. Well, the plot came unraveled. Charlie had too much beer, as I recall, in a bar one night and spilled the beans. And I always point out, only the Texas legislature would have had the foresight to make it illegal to pay someone to shoot you. It is illegal in our state, so don't come down and do it, Terry. And with that, Mike Martin became a wanted man. But instead of facing up to his then legal difficulties, Mike Martin took it on the lam. He went underground. He went into hiding. And we had to send the Texas Rangers after him. They hunted him high, hunted him low. Took him 2 weeks to track Martin to earth. He was hidden at his mother's house outside Longview. And they actually found him hiding in the stereo cabinet. Now, many people have asked me what Martin was doing in that stereo cabinet. I'm here to tell you that man always did want to be a speaker.
Has the Texas legislature changed in the years that you've been a journalist?
You know, I wish I could tell you it's gotten better. I always think when I'm asked that question, people can say, oh, surely it's not as bad as it used to be. And I always think, no, of course not. They're much more serious and sober and responsible these days. And then some lunatic thing happens. I mean, something just so off the wall that you just sit back and laugh and say, no, it hasn't changed a bit. Oh, just this last session, we had some buttes. One night, about 30 members of the Texas House of Representatives bolted out of the place. They were trying to break a quorum, refused to vote again. The speaker locked the doors. They sent the Texas Rangers out after these 30 missing members. They had all gone to take shelter over in the governor's mansion and were hiding out there. And the mansion was ringed by police, and the whole thing was kind of festive. And I thought to myself, by George, only in Texas. This is a lot of fun. Then we had another kind of tragic incident. We had a lawmaker who died of a crack overdose. We think we're the first state on the block to have a lawmaker die of a crack overdose. While that was sufficiently depressing in a sort of typically frolicsome Texas political way, it turned out that before the guy's body was discovered, but certainly after he died, he continued by some magical means to vote. He was registered on several votes there in the Texas House after he was deceased.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Molly Ivins. There's a new collection of her columns from over the years. It's called Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She? We'll talk some more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Molly Ivins is my guest. The title of your new book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?, comes from an actual story. Would you tell the story?
When I first started writing a column for the Dallas Times-Herald back in 1982, I found Dallas, Texas to be really quite a buttoned-up sort of town, really very proper. And they were not used to someone with my kind of freewheeling style. I reviewed the performance of a local congressman. He was Republican from North Dallas, and took a look at what he'd done lately, and it caused me to render the judgment that if that man's IQ slipped any lower, we'd have to water him twice a day. Well, that, good heavens, touched off all kinds of outraged protests from Republicans around there, and they all threatened to cancel their subscriptions and start advertiser boycotts and such, and my paper did kind of a gutsy thing. They took out billboards all over Dallas, Texas that said, Molly Ivins can't say that, can she?
And what effect did that advertising campaign have? How did it go over?
Well, it's been real interesting. Every year they do polls to see who is the best liked and most hated columnist in Dallas, and I'm always both of them. So we figure that means people are reading it.
That's great. Now, is it right that the New York Times fired you for describing a community chicken-killing festival as a gang pluck?
That comes close to the truth. I actually,
how close?
I resigned from the Times, but I was not in good smell with the powers that be, and it was over the time I tried to call that community chicken killing a gang pluck. They felt that was conduct unbecoming a New York Times reporter.
And how did they let you know that?
Oh, I had this hilarious interview with Abe Rosenthal, then the executive editor of the Times. I had been Rocky Mountain bureau chief for the New York Times for 3 years, covered 9 mountain states out in from the Canadian to the Mexican border. It was a wonderful assignment. And that's where I wrote the story about the community chicken slaughter. And when I got back to New York, I was abruptly recalled, kind of like a defective automobile. Abe hauled me into his office, and we kind of went around about whether or not I was deliberately trying to stick my thumb in the eye of the New York Times, as I recall his words, and I explained that, no, I never tried to do that, actually. I just never understood where they drew the line at the Times, and when it was pointed out to me, my honest reaction was always, you've got to be kidding. So we argued that up and down a bit, and then he said, in an accusatory tone, you tried to call that community chicken killing a gang pluck. I said, yes, Abe, I did. He said, gang pluck. I said, well, Abe, I thought it was a good line. He said, gang pluck. I said, hey, well, Abe, it's a play on words. He said, gang pluck. That is a play on gang fuck. You were trying to make our readers think of the word fuck. I said, damn, Abe, you are a hard man to fool. You are going to have to cut that story, you know it.
I'm wondering, you know, some people from Texas end up telling stories about their state and everything. Do you think that some people camp it up a little bit when telling colorful stories about the South?
Yes and no. There's a genre of person that we refer to somewhat scornfully as professional Texans. I must say, sometimes I feel in danger of becoming a professional Texan myself. And people who, you know, have lived up here in the North and who dine out on old stories for many years, eventually becoming terrible bores to everyone, including themselves. There is an almost irresistible tendency to play Texan, however. I remember when I first joined the Times, the editors were taking me around and they'd introduce me to someone and say, this is Molly Ivins, she just joined the paper, she's from Texas. And people would look up very expectantly and say, oh, from Texas? And I found myself sticking out my hand and saying, howdy. You know, I just didn't want to let anybody down.
Right.
And there is an extent to which you play the role, particularly if you're a Texan in the North, because people expect it of you and enjoy it. And sometimes I feel when I'm in the North as though I speak two languages and they only speak one.
But you speak North and South?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you about a couple of stories I'm sure you're following sure. now. If you were voting on the confirmation of Gates to head the CIA, what questions would you want to ask him before voting? What would you want to know?
Interesting question. I'm not sure you can get at the straight of it or even get him to say. I'm intrigued by the new charges. Not concerning Iran-Contra, but that he habitually tailored intelligence reports to meet political purposes, which seems to me a particularly pernicious practice. But I had already concluded on the matter of his involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal, or lack of same, that if this man was sitting there, number two in the CIA, with all these people all around him warning him and tipping him off and telling him about this piece of evidence and that piece of evidence, and he didn't have enough sense to figure out what was going on, then we don't want him as head of the CIA. I mean, honey, if he's fit to head an intelligence agency after a performance like that, then I'm about to be named National Junior Baton Twirling Champion.
How would you vote on the Clarence Thomas confirmation?
I think that my initial reaction on Thomas was wrong. My theory was that you might as well vote for him and not even bother to put up a fight because it's a done deal, and the next, if by any chance you defeated him, the next nominee through the pipeline might look even worse. I have since concluded that I was wrong about that, and I was actually convinced by Howell Heflin's speech. Howell Heflin of Alabama, certainly no great flaming liberal, actually voted against Thomas on the Judiciary Committee and will oppose his nomination. And it seemed to me that Howell Heflin, who, and this is relatively rare, as we all know, for a politician, was certainly acting against his own best political interests. The people in his home state want Thomas confirmed by an overwhelming margin. But Heflin just stood up and said, he's not good enough. He's just not good enough. And all of us know, I mean, whether you think Thomas is an acceptable candidate or not, that George Bush did not simply say to the people around him, go out and find me the brightest and best qualified candidate, and that they came back with Clarence Thomas. Now, that just didn't happen.
So what do you think now would happen if Thomas is voted down? What do you think the next choice might be like?
I think the next choice is probably Edith Jones of Texas, or at least that's what we hear. And I'll tell you frankly, she's such a wretched choice that I think she could be defeated quite easily. And as you recall, after Nixon lost two attempted court appointees that he named, both of whom were unfit for the high court in almost everybody's opinion, then he finally turned around and appointed a very good judge, Harry Blackmun. I think the same thing might happen this time.
In Texas circles, do you ever end up at parties with some of the politicians who you cover?
Yes, I do. I have always been something of an outsider journalist because my political opinions aren't popular in my home state. Yes, I have over the years socialized with Texas politicians.
Does that make it harder to say what you want to say about them?
Not for me.
Do you ever learn anything that gives you insights into their character or politics from the parties?
I'm trying to think. Yes, I suppose so. Although, as a journalist, stuff that you learn that you can't use really isn't that much use to you.
I bet you see a lot of stuff that you can't use at those parties.
Yeah, but I love to make fun of politicians, and as far as I'm concerned, they're all in a free fire zone. But I do have some respect for their privacy. Even the dimmest of them actually devote a fair number of hours to public service, and I think they deserve some respect for their privacy.
Molly Ivins, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
All right. It was my pleasure.
And there's a new collection of Molly Ivins' columns over the years, and it's called Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She? This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court is now before the full Senate. He's expected to be confirmed, even though the Senate Judiciary Committee didn't give him its recommendation. The Thomas confirmation hearings may ultimately result in hearings to reform the confirmation process. Coming up, we ask Duke Law Professor Walter Dellinger to critique the confirmation process. Today, white South African novelist Nadine Gordimer won the Nobel Prize for Literature. We'll hear a talk with her from our archives. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Reports out of Port-au-Prince say random attacks by soldiers have left 150 people dead and more than 300 wounded in Haiti this week. One radio station says 30 to 40 people were massacred in one neighborhood. The report says most of the attacks occurred between early Monday, when President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was ousted, and Wednesday. Robert Gates is defending himself against charges that he systematically slanted intelligence. Gates is President Bush's nominee to head the CIA. Today, he said he never twisted reports to support administration policies. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Robert Gates today rebutted 20 charges made against him, ranging from slanting intelligence on Soviet influence in Iran to misleading officials about Soviet involvement in an assassination attempt on Pope John Paul II. Gates was clearly angry and spoke to the committee like a man who knew his career was on the line.
We were wrong at times, but our judgments were honest and unaffected by a desire to please or to slant.
Republicans on the committee are still solidly locked in favor of Gates' confirmation, but support among Democrats on the committee has waffled over the last few days. Several say the cumulative effect of the charges of poor management and poor judgment have left too many doubts. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Nobel Prize for Literature has gone to Nadine Gordimer, a white South African novelist and anti-apartheid activist. Gordimer is the first woman to win the prize in 25 years and the first South African. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Gordimer is the author of 10 novels and more than 200 short stories, many of which deal with the moral dilemmas of living under apartheid. She spoke at a press conference in New York today.
Writers like myself who've become known in the outside world, we have given the outside world an extra dimension, apart from the daily news, of what racism and what apartheid in particular has meant in the lives of people, in their personal lives.
At one time, three of Gordimer's books were banned by the South African government. In naming Gordimer today, the Swedish Academy said she had combined literary artistry with a strong anti-apartheid message that was of great benefit to humanity. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Members of the House voted today to close their private bank after reports surfaced that thousands of dollars in bad checks were written by some House members. The bank will close at the end of the year, and members will be forced to move their accounts to the House Credit Union or a commercial institution. On Wall Street, stock prices finished lower, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average losing nearly 28 points to close at 2984.79. Declines led advances by a margin of 2-1 in active trading of 175 million shares. This is NPR News. Promising leadership that will restore the American dream, Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton today entered the 1992 Democratic presidential race. Clinton is the second governor and fifth major Democratic candidate to join the field. German unification anniversary celebrations were marred by continued attacks against refugee shelters. The ongoing assaults began more than 2 weeks ago. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Police say at least 16 attacks were carried out last night and today in Germany against homes for foreigners, causing some serious injuries. For instance, two Lebanese children were severely burned in the western part of Germany when skinheads set their refugee shelter on fire. In the eastern part of Germany, on the island of Rügen, a gang of armed youth assaulted and burned down a refugee shelter. There were demonstrations in numerous German cities today, such as Berlin and Hamburg, to protest the growing number of racist-motivated attacks. Meanwhile, Chancellor Helmut Kohl said in a TV speech to the nation that much remains to be done, but most East Germans live better now than a year before. Kohl telephoned Soviet leader Gorbachev today to thank him for Soviet support of the unification process. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Serbia and three of its allies in Yugoslavia today declared they were taking over the powers of the country's parliament. The government body controls the Yugoslav budget and appoints the federal cabinet. The move came at a meeting of the collective presidency. Serbia, the largest and most dominant republic, appeared to be taking the last remaining power of the federal government, which has been steadily weakened by the civil war. Former Peruvian President Alan Garcia has been impeached by the Chamber of Deputies. Last night's vote was the first ever by the chamber to impeach a former president. The Senate must now decide by a simple majority whether to have Garcia stand trial. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The full Senate began debate today on the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. It looks like he will easily get the majority vote. If the Senate confirms Thomas, he will be the first Supreme Court justice to be confirmed without the recommendation of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Some people are saying it's time to reform the confirmation process. We invited Duke Law Professor Walter Dellinger to give us his critique of the process. Dellinger was surprised at the Judiciary Committee's split vote. He says it's a sign that some of the senators on the committee reevaluated their role as the hearings progressed.
I think as we went into the Thomas nomination, it was assumed that the Senate had to prove that there was something wrong with the nominee in order to justify a rejection. I think the very process of hearings has helped create the assumption that this is a nominee on trial, and therefore, in order to vote no, you must prove, quote, beyond a reasonable doubt that the nominee is guilty of some sort of failing, either personal or in being a dangerous radical. I think towards the end of the process, at least some members of the Senate Judiciary Committee began to ask, why can't we just say that there ought to be a better nominee? Why does there have to be this burden on those who would vote no? Why isn't the burden on the president and his nominee to demonstrate that he or she is a person that would clearly bring distinction to the Supreme Court? And that tended, I think, to shift the vote in the committee fairly dramatically at the end of the process.
Senator Biden has suggested that there be a set of hearings to review the confirmation process. Would you like to see that happen?
I think this is the ideal time, after this nomination is over and before the next nomination, and we are certainly likely to have vacancies on this court, almost at the rate of one a year for the next couple of years. It's essential that we sit back between confirmation battles and ask whether this process is the process that we ought to have, and can this process be saved, and can it be more satisfactory? So I'm eager to see these hearings take place.
I'm interested in hearing more of your critique of the confirmation process. Let's look at the questioning process during the Senate Judiciary hearings. Several Democratic senators tried to really press Thomas on his views of abortion. Was that appropriate? Thomas resisted giving answers to those questions.
You know, I found this one of the most difficult issues to deal with, and I have really agonized with it in my own mind. And finally, towards the end of this process, came to a final conclusion, and that is this, that a nominee ought to be able to say and discuss any issue that a sitting member of the court would be willing to discuss. And I've reflected on those occasions when justices like Justice Scalia or Justice Blackmun have appeared at Duke Law School and at other campuses and thought about what do they feel free to talk about? And they certainly feel free to talk about what they think about the general proposition of Roe versus Wade. If you ask Justice Scalia whether he thought the 14th Amendment's Liberty Clause protected a woman's fundamental interest in terminating a pregnancy, he would say, no, I don't. And he would say that in public at a law school forum. And Justice Blackmun would say, yes, I do. I believe the right to make reproductive choices is as fundamental a liberty as there is and can't be abridged without a compelling interest. Now, I think Judge Thomas was therefore perfectly free to offer either of those opinions to the Senate. Here's where I would draw the line. If you ask a sitting justice like Scalia or Blackmun, do you believe that the Pennsylvania abortion control law, which has just been invalidated by the district court, is constitutional or not? They would say, I can't answer that question. That is a statute that is being tested in the court, and that case is likely to come before the Supreme Court in the very near future. And I need to wait and see what the briefs and what the arguments are before I make up my mind on that case. So I know this is a fine line, but I think they can discuss their view of whether the Constitution is a general proposition, treats a personal decision like continuing or terminating a pregnancy as a fundamental liberty, without discussing a particular state statute to come before the court.
My guest is Walter Dellinger, and he's a professor of law at Duke University. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Dellinger. He's a professor of law at Duke University. Are there questions you would have liked to ask that weren't asked of Thomas?
I think, by and large, the right questions were asked. I think that the hearings process doesn't lend itself, as presently structured, to a very effective dialogue. Each senator has 20 minutes to ask questions. There is a unfortunate tendency of senators to use much of the 20 minutes engaging at what some see as their own preening display of knowledge before in the last minute or two finally getting to a question. So the questioning doesn't occur at very much depth. I look back at the Fortas hearings, Terry, and it was interesting. Each senator questioned the nominee one time for as long as he wished to ask questions, so that Senator Ervin, Sam Ervin, questioned Judge Ford, as he had been nominated for Chief Justice, questioned him for not 20 minutes, but 2.5 days, during which time you can explore a lot of the nominee's views. I guess I would like to have seen more questions that would give us a sense of whether Judge Thomas has had much real legal experience. I think one of the concerns that emerged in the question didn't bring it out is that while he has had a very interesting career, he hasn't had the opportunity to really do much law. That is, he's run a couple of major agencies at quite a young age, the Education Department Civil Rights Office and the EEOC. But what is, in a sense, missing from his biography are years early in his career when he was in the library at night studying cases and statutes. And so he is unfortunately, I think, thinly prepared as compared with other nominees. And more detailed questioning might have given us a better sense of the extent to which that's true.
That leads to the issue, what intellectual and professional distinction should be required for the job of Supreme Court Justice? And how can that best be evaluated by the Senate?
Well, what are we looking for in Supreme Court justices? The first key point is that there is no one model for a good Supreme Court justice. And in fact, you wouldn't want 9 members of the court who had the same kinds of distinctions or the same kinds of backgrounds. Anytime there's a vacancy on the court, you ought to think about what's missing from the court. And there are certainly several things missing. First of all is simple intellectual distinction. I think many believe this is one of the least intellectually distinguished courts we've had in a very long time. Secondly, this court is lacking any member or members who played a prominent role in the public life of the nation before going on the court. gee, the court in 1954 that decided the Brown versus the Board of Education that ended Jim Crow, every member of that court had played a prominent role in public life. Three U.S. senators, the most powerful governor of California, Earl Warren, three attorneys general. On this court, we have one member who served briefly in a state legislature, Justice O'Connor, and a couple of justices who were number three or number four down in the Justice Department as assistant attorneys general. But really no one who understands how the nation works, and I think that's a great lack.
If there are hearings on the confirmation process, do you think there should be any new guidelines on the questioning process?
Well, I think one of the most important things that a reexamination of the confirmation process could do is to ask more broadly whether the hearings are serving their proper purpose. We went 125 years in this country with no nominee ever appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Not until 1925 did the first person ever appear. And not really until 1959 did we begin a steady tradition of nominees appearing before the hearing. And I think as a result, in recent years, we've made the hearings too central a part of the process that the Senate ought to be expected to ask before the hearings whether a nominee is a person of demonstrated high achievement, rather than having senators be expected to prove that out of the nominee's mouth at the hearing.
If up to 1955 there weren't confirmation hearings, with the nominee testifying at the hearings, what were the hearings like?
Well, the hearings were actually just committee meetings at which the nominee's record was reviewed. In the absence of a hearing, it seemed less like a sort of, quote, due process trial, and more like what it is, which is a political decision for the Senate. And during the period when there were no hearings and no nominees appearing, the Senate felt very free to reject really about 25% of all the president's nominations on the basis that their record led the Senate to believe there might be someone better. Now, I think the most important reform we could make in the process would be to engage the Senate in an advice-giving role to the president prior to the president's naming an individual. Now, the Constitution specifically contemplates this. Article 2 provides that the president shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate appoint judges of the Supreme Court. What is missing in the past decade has been a process whereby the president sat down with the Senate. I think if you had that process, if the Senate even put forward publicly some of the names they were suggesting, suppose this time the Senate leadership had suggested after Marshall's resignations names like Dean Guido Calabresi of the Yale Law School or former Secretary Carla Hills, Judge Harry Edwards of the D.C. Circuit, an African-American judge who was one of the most distinguished lawyers and scholars in the United States before he spent 12 years. Then at least the president's nominee would be compared with the, you know, with the kind of people that were not chosen.
You'd like to see the Senate emphasize its advise role more in the confirmation process, as opposed to just the consent role in the advise and consent. If the president nominates the Supreme Court justices, it's possible that the justices will reflect the president's point of view and not be as strong as we might like in providing the checks and balances to the executive power. Is that why you want to see the Senate take a stronger role in the nominating process?
It is. I think what is critically important about the court is whether we will have a group of men and women with life tenure and a judicial tradition who will stand between the state and the individual. That there are many observers of the court who are concerned that the direction of the present court is a direction of of judges who are what we call that familiar type, the government judge. Judges who are willing to rule with and go along with the government. Now, the president is certainly entitled to seek judges who will uphold the power of the government and uphold the power of his executive, but it's the role of the Senate to resist that. The framers of the Constitution considered giving the president the power to appoint judges, and they rejected that idea. In fact, the Constitutional Convention in the early drafts overwhelmingly voted to have the Senate exclusively name all judges and to give the president no role at all. Only at the end of the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was it decided to give the president some role, that is, the role of nominating. And even then, the principal drafter of that provision, Gouverneur Morris of Pennsylvania, said that this final article on judicial appointment still gives the principal authority to the Senate. The Senate will choose the justices out of those nominated to them by the president. So we've gotten a very long way from an original understanding that the Senate would play a principal role, and more are deferential to presidential authority.
Well, Walter Dellinger, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts on the confirmation process.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed being with you.
Walter Dellinger is a law professor at Duke University. This is Fresh Air. Well, we can't check in with the hosts of All Things Considered now, but I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up. Today, Robert Gates, the president's nominee to head the CIA, defended himself against charges that he slanted intelligence reports to suit administration beliefs. He called the charges ridiculous. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports that support among Democrats has eroded because of the charges. And NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Berlin on German unity 1 year later. Ceremonies marking the historic anniversary were low-key as Germany grapples with economic turmoil and an upsurge in violence against foreigners. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today, Nadine Gordimer became the first woman in 25 years to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. Gordimer is a white South African and a longtime opponent of her country's racist policies. Many of her novels and short stories are about the agonies of apartheid. Some of her works have been banned in her country. The Nobel Prize judges said her stories have been a very great benefit to humanity. I spoke to Gordimer in May of 1989 during one of her visits to the United States, and I asked her if the injustices of her country are what compelled her to become a writer.
Writing was not a response to injustice. I wasn't even aware of injustice. I began to write out of a sense of wonder at life and also out of the mystery of life, wanting to find out what it was all about. It was my way of exploring life. And I think this is true of all artists. That's at the base of what we do. I don't think that any real artist begins from a political stimulation or conscience.
Well, let me read to you a statement that you once said about writing. You said that the best way to write is to do so as if one were already dead, afraid of no one's reactions, answerable to no one's views. What led you to say that? And I guess I wonder if you've taken heat by, on both sides in South Africa.
No, this was just a conviction that goes really deeper than that. I think that a writer must always maintain the independence, the artistic independence, to use his or her insights, something that a writer has beyond the insights of other people, without worrying whether you're going to offend your mother, your best friend, or whether your political confreres are going to decide that you have let down the side. A writer must never let herself become a propagandist. Propagandists have a place. Agitprop has a place. But I'm not that kind. I'm not that person. I'm a writer. I have a certain ability, and I feel the first duty is to use that ability properly. The nearest you can get to the truth, you get through using that ability properly, not worrying what anybody's going to say. That's why I would stand by that old statement, you know, that you must write as if you're already dead and not worry about the consequences. Because as soon as you've got your eye on an audience, on people who are watching, you're going to hear what you have to say, you're going to falsify that little extra vision you have that will bring you near to the truth. And in the end, if we look at your position, the writer's position in society, the essential gesture to society, in the end, it is what you're going to be able to record and discover of the truth that is going to serve your society best.
Do you feel that you've ever been expected to write books that would be more effective propaganda?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Where has that pressure come from?
Well, it hasn't really been pressure. And it hasn't usually come from quarters that bothered me very much. Because I feel that if I took no part in community life and lived in an ivory tower, then perhaps I might listen to it. But I'm also a human being, a citizen, and I know that I have a certain responsibility toward my society for what's happened there, what's happened in my name as a white, whether I had anything to do with it or not. And so I have another part of my life which, where I put my life on the line for what I believe in. And I think, therefore, I have the freedom to write as I feel I must, as I please. I'm not retiring into an ivory tower because I am doing other things as a human being and a citizen.
Nadine Gordimer from a 1989 interview. Today she won the Nobel Prize in Literature. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Michael Clare applauds President Bush for cutting back our nuclear arsenal in Eastern Europe, but Clare says this isn't a sign of disarmament. It's the beginning of rearmament to fight the wars of the post-Cold War era. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with professor and journalist Michael Clare. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.
It's All Things Considered from National Public Radio.